with insurgent groups such as ISIS and Boko Haram dealing death and panic from Iraq to Nigeria and beyond. Our next guest is uniquely qualified to talk about strategies the U.S. and its allies might employ against today's enemies. As an Army officer, John Noggle commanded a tank platoon in the Persian Gulf War, led a tank battalion during the war in Iraq, then earned a PhD at Oxford, and served as a key member of the Pentagon team that wrote the Army's manual on counterinsurgency. He joins us to talk about the strategy the Army should use in today's small wars, where protecting civilians and establishing legitimate governments are just as important as destroying enemies in combat. John Noggle joins us next on Midday after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone, our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. Hardly a day goes by without headlines about a new attack or atrocity by the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, Boko Haram in Nigeria, or Al-Qaeda throughout the Middle East. These fanatic groups are the face of warfare in the 21st century, but still a puzzle to policymakers and military strategists who learn to think of combat as sweeps by tank battalions and waves of infantry in the aftermath of World War II. Our next guest says defeating modern insurgencies takes a different kind of thinking and a willingness to commit substantial forces, time, money, and effort, because there's no quick fix. John Noggle may be uniquely qualified in this subject as both a fighting man and a scholar. As an Army officer, he commanded a tank platoon during the lightning-fast Old War victory by Allied forces in Operation Desert Storm in 1991. More than a decade later, he was a battalion commander in a more difficult and bloody battle against a stubborn insurgency in Iraq after the defeat of Saddam Hussein's regular army. Between wars, John Noggle earned a PhD from Oxford with a thesis on the right way and the wrong way to fight an insurgency. His scholarship and battle experience led him to the Pentagon, where he was a key member of the team that wrote the official counterinsurgency manual used by the Army and Marine Corps. In a new memoir called Knife Fights, John Noggle argues that America's political and military leaders may be too quick to forget the hard-won lessons about fighting insurgencies, first in Vietnam and later in Iraq. Unlike the search-and-destroy tactics of earlier wars, he says, battles against insurgents are won by keeping the Army engaged with local communities and security forces, by protecting civilians against insurgents so they'll help find the enemy, and encouraging development of legitimate local governments. John Noggle says this kind of warfare is long and tedious. At best, it may lead to a result that can only be described as less bad than the alternatives. The U.S., he writes, has rarely had the patience for this kind of war. But if it doesn't, the future may be a lot darker than the past. John Noggle is a 1988 West Point graduate, retired lieutenant colonel of the U.S. Army. As a civilian, John served as president of the Center for a New American Security, a Washington think tank, before embarking on a third career in education, now as headmaster of the Haverford School near Philadelphia. His first book on counterinsurgency was titled Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife. We'll tell you about that title when we talk to him. The latest is called Knife Fights, a memoir of modern war in theory and practice. Penguin Press is the publisher. John Noggle, I want to welcome you to Midday on WYPR, and thanks for taking time to talk with us.
Dan, it's a delight to be with you. I have to correct one thing from your overly generous
introduction. Oh, what was that?
I was not the battalion commander. I was the battalion operations officer in Iraq in 2003, 2004. Oh. That doesn't mean anything at all to you, but Jeff Swisher, who was the battalion commander, hunt me down and kill me if
okay.
I leave that out there.
Sorry about that.
He's a pretty tough guy. So
okay.
No. I just said that for my own preservation.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification, and I'm sorry for the field promotion, but there you go. Hey, I've got to move the clock up a little bit here. We have the whole hour to talk to you about, you know, the backstory of your book and your own story, your own journey. But since this book went to press, there have been some major developments in the nature of insurgencies. So I want to just start off by asking you about those. For example, in the book, you seem to think that we had set the stage for a reasonably stable situation in Iraq, but then ISIS turned up, seemingly to a lot of us, out of nowhere. So I want to ask you about ISIS. Is the threat of ISIS different from the other insurgencies you've written about?
So ISIS is the successor organization to al-Qaeda in Iraq, which I fought against in El Anbar province in 2003-04. Mm-hmm. We had, broadly speaking, defeated AQI within the borders of Iraq by the time American troops withdrew from Iraq at the end of 2011. Sadly, as I say in the book, we made a critical, unforced error of withdrawing all American troops from Iraq. We made another critical error, I believe, slightly more excusable by not arming and training moderate Syrian rebels in the summer of 2012. The combination of those two mistakes gave room for al-Qaeda in Iraq to regenerate itself in Syria. And it has since poured back across the borders into Iraq. It was able to do so in no small part because we didn't have any American forces on the ground in Iraq at that time. And so we are now fighting the successor organization to al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. It's a real problem. It's particularly going to be a problem in Syria, where we currently don't have a strategy against it. I do believe we'll manage to be reasonably successful against it in the within the borders of Iraq over the course of this year and the next year.
It's sort of a political question, I guess, or just a question as a citizen in the United States. What do you think we can do about it? Should we do something? Can ISIS be defeated with your tactics?
ISIS can be defeated comparatively easy with a significantly greater expenditure of resources and effort than we've provided to date, but with nothing like the surge of troops into Iraq. So we currently have about 1,500 troops on the ground as combat advisors in Iraq. The president has ordered another 1,500 en route, and I'm communicating with some of those guys trying to help them think through the problem they're going to face. So that's a total of about 3,000 American troops committed to the fight against ISIS. I think that number needs to be about five times bigger, about 15,000. Those advisors would embed with and fight with Iraqi and Kurdish battalions against ISIS. And ISIS has essentially culminated. It has reached the limits of its ability to expand across the Sunni areas of Iraq. It no longer has momentum. It doesn't have the ability to produce its own military equipment, its own ammunition, its own weapons. It only can acquire that stuff. And it's diminishing its resources because it's no longer attacking successfully. So I believe that ISIS inside Iraq is a fairly solvable political military problem. We are moving, taking steps in the right direction, but the president has not committed the resources against it that I believe the threat warrants. And I'm going to point to the recent attacks in Paris as an example of the real risk ISIS, the existence of ISIS, the strength of ISIS presents, not just to the Iraqi people, not just to the Syrian people, but to the whole world. It is the vanguard of an ideological Islamic terror movement, and it is currently number one in the world.
John Nagel is our guest. His book is Knife Fights, A Memoir of Modern War in Theory and Practice. And I'll get back to your book and talk about how you came to develop your theories. And I mentioned the title of the earlier book, John, Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife. It's a title that many of our listeners may remember, and some may associate with you, but also with Lawrence of Arabia. So a little bit on that, please. And I think that opens the door for you to discuss the whole idea of counterinsurgency, taking it from that title.
Certainly. When you are studying counterinsurgency, as I was in the wake of Operation Desert Storm, my first war, I became convinced that future enemies of the United States were not going to confront us tank on tank, fighter plane on fighter plane. They have no chance of succeeding if they fight us directly. Instead, I believed after Desert Storm that our future enemies would fight us as insurgents and terrorists. And the Army thought that was an interesting, slightly crazy idea, and sent me back to Oxford to get my PhD to write about that question. And when I was at Oxford studying that question, studying insurgency, counterinsurgency, those kinds of wars, I read the works of T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, who had led a band of Arab guerrillas against a conventional Western army during the First World War with enormous success. And Lawrence was thinking about the success his insurgents, his guerrillas had had. And he said, the enemy we're fighting against, the conventional Western army we're fighting against, in his case, a Turkish army in the First World War, that they are not able to fight us. For them, we're like a vapor. We rise up out of the sand, we congeal, we strike, and then we dissolve back into the sand. They're a blind boxer. They could kill us if they could only find us. For them, war on rebellion was messy and slow, like eating soup with a knife. And I happened to read that phrase in the bathtub. I'd come back from a run in Oxford, and I was in the tub, drinking champagne, eating strawberries, because it's Oxford, that's what you do there, and reading T. Lawrence, and I literally came out of the tub and said, "Eureka, I've found it. I have the title of my dissertation." And so that phrase, learning to eat soup with a knife, I applied to the cases of the British Army in Malaya, which fought a counterinsurgency campaign from 1948 to 1960, and the American Army in Vietnam, which also fought a very long, difficult counterinsurgency campaign. And I used the phrase to illustrate how difficult it is for conventional armies to learn how to fight against enemies who refuse to meet them frontally, as the Iraqi army did. Frontally fought my tank unit in Desert Storm, who instead choose to fight us as insurgents and terrorists to wage war from the shadows, as I saw when I was fighting again the second time in Iraq in 2003 and 2004.
And we thought the second time in Iraq would be similar to the first time in Iraq, to 1991 or the first Persian Gulf War. Why would we think it would be any different?
Well, some people thought it was going to be similar. Some didn't. There were a number of people far smarter and better known than me who warned against invading Iraq to topple the government in Baghdad, who believed that the fragile balance of power among the tribes, the Sunni and the Shia tribes, the Kurds as well, inside Iraq, was a very precarious balance, and that if we upset that balance, very, very bad things might happen. My friend Conrad Crane, a West Point graduate, and by now he'd retired from the Army just prior to the invasion of Iraq. He wrote a paper at the Army War College that said, listen, toppling the government in Baghdad is going to be pretty easy, but what happens afterwards, holy moly, right? Have you upset, have you created a hornet's nest? And Con Crane, like me, opposed for many reasons to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, later became one of the people who helped write the counterinsurgency manual to try to get us out of the mess that we'd advised against getting into in the first place.
Right. No, I understand that some had questions about that, but others who were in charge at the time, Donald Rumsfeld comes to mind, weren't thinking this way. In fact, Donald Rumsfeld didn't like the word insurgency, did he?
Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld, actually forbid the use of the word insurgency inside the Pentagon. Famously, he was standing next to Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Peter Pace, at a press conference, was asked a question about insurgency. Secretary Rumsfeld berated the reporter for using the word, and then turned to Pete Pace, General Pace, and said, General, maybe you'd like to say something about that. And General Pace used the word insurgency in his answer, and he got yelled at then, too. So it's very much like fighting alcoholism. If you don't admit you're an alcoholic, you're never going to deal with the problem. If you can't admit you're fighting an insurgency, you obviously won't implement counterinsurgency techniques, which are messy and slow, as Lawrence suggested, but are historically proven to work, albeit at great cost. So it wasn't until really the departure of Secretary Rumsfeld, his replacement by Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, in my eyes, the greatest Secretary of Defense the nation has ever had, that we were really able to make progress with a new strategy in Iraq.
This is a very well-written book, John Noggle, and also written with a wry sense of humor that leavens the seriousness of the topic for the reader. And I get to this story, I say that as we move to this story that you tell after the Gulf War. You write here that your first real lesson in dealing with insurgencies came during a training exercise, actually. It was after the Gulf War. You were in California. And It was you were sort of attacked by a band of Eskimos. I think our listeners.
It sounds really crazy when you say it that way,
Dan.
I'm
onto something here. So,
the Army is rightly proud. In the wake of Vietnam, it really changed. There was a training revolution in the U.S. Army. Changed the way it's fought. The not just the Army, the Air Force. Established a very good force-on-force training exercises, as did the Marine Corps. The Army's is the one I know best at the National Training Center in Fort Irwin, California. This enormous band of mountainous desert, the size of the state of Rhode Island, and Army units fight against a professional opposing force. The Army has a group of 5,000, a regiment of 5,000 opposing forces whose full-time job is to beat up on rotating Army units to train them up and make them better, sort of like a scout team in football. And this Op 4 we were fighting against had been augmented by a company of Alaskan National Guard infantry. And these guys didn't speak English particularly well, but they crept up on our tanks. We dug in our tanks in a prepared defense. We were planning to defend against an attack by a group of Op 4 tanks. And these Nanooks crept up on us from a direction we weren't expecting through the mountains, and with light tank weapons, light anti-tank weapons and mortars, striking us from a direction we weren't expecting. People we couldn't talk to and couldn't understand defeated us in detail, defeated a tank company of the United States Army in detail, using tactics we weren't expecting and weapons for which we were not prepared. They struck us in the vulnerable, softer parts to the extent the tanks have soft parts. And so this was, although I didn't, that's not true. I didn't realize it immediately at the time. At the time, I was just really, really mad. And the Nanooks used to love when you get hit, when your tank gets hit and it's disabled, there's a flashing light on the top of your tank to simulate your tank in flames. And there's a really annoying sound, a whoop, whoop, whoop,
oh,
in
boy.
Your headphones to indicate that you're dead, sucker. And the Nanooks, after they killed us, would delight in shouting in unison, whoop, whoop,
oh,
whoop.
Oh, boy.
And I reflected later on that experience after I'd caught up on sleep and showered and stuff and realized that it's the Nanooks we needed to worry about. The tanks who were coming to get us, we could have taken care of them pretty easily. But these light fighters using terrain and stealth to attack us in our weak spots, that was the real danger to this American tank unit that just a year before had cleaned up in Desert Storm.
And is that what got you to learning to eat soup with a knife? I mean, you talked about your eureka moment in the bathtub, but also it must have been this experience as well.
So there were a series of experiences,
yeah,
that I realized how extraordinary the American military machine is at conventional combat. In Desert Storm, we were hitting enemy tanks from so far away that they thought it had to be airplanes doing the hitting rather than tanks. Our conventional military superiority over any conceivable enemy was so great. And then I was confronted by that fact was true, but it was also true that these insurgent fighters with nothing more than what they were carrying on their backs could kill us all. And that led me to start reading into the classics of guerrilla warfare and counterinsurgency, like Lawrence of Arabia, the British thinkers, the French thinkers on counterinsurgency. And I realized that this is a very ancient and very form of warfare, and a form of warfare that's very, very difficult for a conventional Western power to defeat.
We'll take a break here, John, and come back and talk some more. This is Midday. Dan Rodrigues here speaking with John Nagel, retired Army officer, strategist, and scholar, whose latest book is called Knife Fights, a memoir of modern war in theory and practice. A short break on Midday. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodrigues here. Our guest, John Nagel, Lieutenant Colonel of the Army, retired. His latest book is Knife Fights, a memoir of modern war in theory and practice. He argues that fighting modern insurgencies, as we did in Iraq, takes a commitment of forces, money, and patience focused as much on building trust in local communities and protecting civilians and establishing legitimate governments as it does to finding and destroying enemy fighters. Your experience in Iraq in 2003, your second time there, was much more difficult and deadly to your fellow soldiers, John. What was so different about it? I don't want to take for granted that we understand the difference. I want to hear it from you.
When you describe my prescriptions for counterinsurgency, it sounds pretty daunting, which of course it should. When we arrived in Al Anbar in 2003, 2004, Al Anbar, the Wild West of Iraq, of overwhelmingly Sunni, 98% Sunni area, a hotbed of the insurgency. We were stationed in a town named Chaldea in between the provincial capital of Ramadi and the important local town of Fallujah, which was a scene of very, very bitter fighting, some of the bitterest fighting the United States has done since Vietnam. And so we were in a tough place, a Sunni place, where the insurgency was catching fire when we arrived. And our young men started to die almost immediately. In Desert Storm, the fight was against an enemy who looked like us, who wore conventional uniforms, fought in armored vehicles, and we could tell who our enemy was. In my second Iraq war, in the counterinsurgency campaign in Iraq, the insurgents looked just like everyone else. They didn't wear uniforms. They hid among the people. They were, to use Mao's phrase, fish swimming in the sea of the people. They used the people as protection, and they fought us using sniper rifles, firing from buildings and then disappearing, from explosions of roadside bombs, improvised explosive devices that were the deadliest killer of our young men. They fired rocket-propelled grenades at our tanks from very close ranges from inside buildings and then disappeared. And so we fought an enormously difficult fight for that year in Al Anbar. We lost 22 fine young men. We had more than 150 men and women wounded. We tried hard to establish a local government, to build rapport with the people, to determine who these insurgents were, to map the networks of our enemies, and then to take them off the battlefield by killing them or capturing them, by conducting raids at 3 o'clock in the morning to visit their houses. But the houses didn't have addresses, and you couldn't tell one house from another. And so we often detained the wrong man and brought him back in jail. And that process of detaining the wrong man actually inspired more rebellion and created an even stronger insurgency against us. And so after a year of bitter fighting in Al Anbar province, we came back to Fort Riley, Kansas, and my battle captain printed up coffee mugs that said Iraq 2003-2004. We were winning when I left. Because we weren't,
yeah.
And we knew it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tough fight. Horrible.
What was the road for you to the Army's official counterinsurgency manual, this guide? How did you get there?
Mm-hmm. So I was assigned after my service in Iraq as the operations officer of my tank battalion as a senior major. I actually was promoted to lieutenant colonel on the very day I was assigned to the Pentagon to work for Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz in the office right next door to Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld. And I was a military assistant to Secretary Wolfowitz. I was supposed to help him think about counterinsurgency, to help him think about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the broader war against radical Islamic extremism and terrorism. And in that office, I became reacquainted with a number of old friends, including a man who'd been one of my professors at West Point, then a captain, a man named David Petraeus. And David Petraeus, by this point, had earned his general stars, was a lieutenant general. I'd actually worked with him a little bit in Iraq late in my tour, and now he was also back in the States after his second Iraq tour, and he came to visit Secretary Wolfowitz, and I got to see him and told then Lieutenant General Petraeus that the Army needed to rewrite its instruction manual on how to fight a counterinsurgency campaign. We hadn't done that successfully since Vietnam, and it was, I told him, time to start from basic principles and rethink how we were conducting this war. Petraeus said, "That's a really good idea. Why don't you get to work on that, Noggle?"
And eventually, we had the surge in Iraq.
We did. And so that discussion with Petraeus happened in November of 2005. A team under the aforementioned Conrad Crane, who coincidentally was Petraeus's West Point classmate, Stanford PhD in history, Con Crane, me, Frank Hoffman of the Marines, others, all under the leadership of Petraeus and his comrade, partner in crime, Lieutenant General Jim Mattis of the United States Marine Corps. We pulled together and started writing the Counterinsurgency Field Manual in December of 2005. We published it in December of 2006, exactly a year later. The book had a fairly extraordinary reception, translated and critiqued on jihadi websites, copies found in Taliban training camps in Pakistan. So our enemies were reading it. We had to get our guys to do that. That's a separate story. Happy to talk about that. The real importance of the book, though, was that the guy who'd spent the last year writing it, thinking about it, thinking it through, going through every page with a red pen over and over again, Dave Petraeus, was assigned to take command in Iraq. So he had a new strategy. He had written the strategy, and a little over a month after we published, he was in command in Iraq, in an Iraq that was clearly going rapidly downhill, descending into full-scale civil war. So that was the real importance of the book, was that it influenced the thinking, the planning of General David Petraeus.
And that gets us to 2007, am I right?
It does. Exactly right. So,
okay.
I think early February 2007 was when the surge began and Petraeus took command in Iraq over an additional 30,000 troops, buttressing the perhaps 150,000 we had in country at that point. More important, I think, than the additional troops was the new strategy they were assigned to implement, Petraeus's counterinsurgency strategy.
And we should also note there that there was a change in secretariat. 2006, I believe, right?
Rumsfeld left. That's exactly right. Yeah. So the midterm elections of 2006, like the midterm elections of last year of 2014, crushing defeat for the administration in 2006. Both the House and the Senate flipped from Republicans to Democrats. Stung by that, President George W. Bush, in my eyes, made the best personnel decision of his presidency, replacing Secretary Rumsfeld with Bob Gates. And Gates's influence in all of this, his leadership, inspirational and vital. And between Petraeus and Gates and many, many others and lots of hard work on the ground, we managed to turn a situation that was a disaster into something that was reasonably tolerable, or had the prospect to be reasonably tolerable. An Iraq, a reasonably democratic Iraq, that would implement a foreign policy that was not in opposition to that of the United States in the region, with a prospect for long-term stationing of American troops and, more importantly, intelligence assets in Iraq. That was a far better outcome than we ever could have predicted in 2006 as the country was sliding into civil war.
You're listening to Midday on WYPR. Dan Roderick's here. My guest is John Nagel, N-A-G-L, Lieutenant Colonel Army, retired. His book, Knife Fights, A Memoir of Modern War in Theory and Practice. Now I'm going to say something here and then introduce Greg, one of our listeners who's called in with a question for you. And before I go to Greg, I just want to say to some people, it will sound like endless war, that a true counterinsurgency to reach all the goals established in these principles, which are, I think they're good principles, establishing a legitimate government that lasts, something that's sustainable, sounds very daunting to American citizens. Perhaps people might say, with John's advocating endless war. I'm just going to say that. And then we're going to go to Greg, because Greg's...
And you're going to leave that hanging there?
Get a chance to answer, because I want to bring Greg in here, because I think Greg is onto at least the same question. So, Greg, welcome.
That was, in fact, a good intro. As a veteran, I'm quite reluctant to commit American troops or even American arms without a clear endgame, without knowing under what conditions we can declare victory and go home. So my question is, when do these additional troops that you think we should have left in Iraq get to come home? When the two branches of Islam don't hate each other and want to kill each other anymore? When the government can be trusted to be not corrupt and alienate half of its population? And when the Iraqi army won't be so alienated that at the first sign of battle they run away and leave all these weapons we gave them to the Islamic State?
Should I go ahead, Dan?
You have the floor, John.
Thank you, sir. Greg, I share your reluctance to commit American troops. I hope I made it clear that I did not favor the invasion of Iraq in 2003. However, once we invaded, it became very much in America's national interests, I believe, for Iraq to be a stable place and not to be a cauldron that inspires terrorism around the globe, which it is again now, I'm afraid, with ISIS. And so I lay out in the final chapter of my book, Counterinsurgency Revisited, a series of requirements which I believe policymakers should consider before they commit American troops to combat. But I think it's essential to realize that once we commit American troops to combat, they don't ever come home. So we still have more than 70 years after the end of the Second World War, American troops in Germany, Italy, and Japan. We still have more than 60 years after the end of the Korean War, American troops in Korea. We don't still have American troops in Vietnam because we lost that one. We still have American troops in the former Yugoslavia. We have American troops in the Sinai. We have American troops again now in Iraq. And it is my belief that we will keep American troops in Iraq and in Afghanistan for decades to come, just as we have after all of the wars we fought in the 20th century, save the First World War. Had we kept American troops in Germany after the First World War, stationed American troops in Germany after the First World War, the Second World War might not have been necessary. And so I strongly believe that if a foreign policy situation is a vital enough national interest to commit the blood of America's sons and daughters to that ground, that it is important enough to leave American troops there pretty much forever in order to keep whatever led that first war to happen from breaking out again. That's that is not necessarily a popular viewpoint. It is, I believe, a practical one that minimizes the bloodshed over time that will have to be expended, especially if we don't make mistakes like invading Iraq unnecessarily in 2003.
Thank you, John. John, we'll take a break here and come back and talk some more. John Nagel, our guest, Knife Fights, his book, a memoir, of modern war in theory and practice, published by the Penguin Press. John, Lieutenant Colonel of the Army, retired, now headmaster at the Haverford School near Philadelphia. We'll talk some more with him when we get back. Phone calls, questions are welcome here on Midday. And welcome back to Midday, our conversation with John Nagel and his book, Knife Fights. John, I appreciate the way you answer that question, that phrase, endless war, which is used quite a bit. It shows up in the title of books, and people use that phrase. You're not talking about that, though. It sounds to me like there is end game. It's a long end game. This is a long strategy. It takes commitment and time and resources, but it isn't all about war eventually, right?
That's exactly right, Dan. And I think the best book that uses that title and that idea, Dexter Filkin's book, The Forever War, suggests how long this war is going to be. And I personally believe that these wars started back in 1993 with the first bombing, the car bombing of the World Trade Center. It did not succeed in bringing the towers down. Obviously, 8 years later, they tried again with planes rather than with a van, and they succeeded the second time. But we are in fact part of a war inside Islam. There's a strain of radical Islamist thought that believes that Islam needs to return to the caliphate, to pure Sharia law over the full extent of the Islamic world, and that in order to succeed in doing that, it needs to defeat the will to resist of the West, of the United States, of France, of Britain, and so it is attacking us, and we saw this again last week in Paris. I do believe that is going to be a very long war. It's already been going for more than 20 years. I don't believe we're halfway through yet, but I believe that we can take steps that will hasten the conclusion of that war. Many, if not most, of those steps are non-military. And one of my particular complaints about the U.S. government and its work in this field is that we have not done a good job of fighting the information war against these radical Islamic extremists who kill far, far more Muslims than they succeed in killing Westerners, who commit apostasies against Islam, which is the religion of Islam itself, is no more warlike than the Christian religion, but these radical Islamists interpret things in horrific ways that would cause the Prophet to shed tears, as we saw on the cover of the French magazine this week. And so I hope that we do a better job of explaining, both to our own people and more importantly to the Islamic world, about the evil and the damage that is being done to Islam in the name of Islam by these radical Islamic extremists. I believe that only by changing people's minds can we ultimately succeed in ending what is likely to be a generational war, a multi-generational war.
Right. John, I think our listeners would wonder, some may be wondering, why you're not still with us, meaning in the military, in the Pentagon. What happened to your own career? Why did you decide to retire?
And that's a more than fair question. So I loved being an Army officer. I loved serving in the Army. I did that for 20 years and retired as a lieutenant colonel now, goodness, coming up for 7 years ago. I was not done with the fight. I left the Army and became the president of the Center for New American Security, a Washington-based national security think tank, and I think did good work there. Served for a number of years on the Defense Policy Board for Secretary of Defense Gates and Panetta and Chuck Hagel, and continue to serve on a Washington advisory board, and obviously have continued to write and speak and think about these issues. So I like to think that I continue to help the nation understand or at least think about this long war in which it is currently engaged in all of its various battles on numerous battlegrounds around the world. However, while all this was happening, while I was doing all of these things, I was also becoming a father. And when I had the opportunity to retire from the Army after what the Army sees as a full career, I had a son who I didn't know and ultimately chose to, for family reasons, I think, to leave the Army and to continue to work in the policy field in Washington. And then when the opportunity came, having, in addition to serving at West Point, I taught at Georgetown University for a while, I taught at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, when I had the chance to become the headmaster of a school for boys, which my son could attend, and engage in a much happier and more hopeful career, continuing to labor, at least part-time, in the vineyards of counterterrorism and counterinsurgency, but spending more of my day thinking about and working with the future of our country, very bright young men, hopefully inspiring them to careers of public service and to become good men who give back to their community and to the world. I just thought it was a wonderful opportunity to embrace some parts of myself that I had neglected during more than a decade of
war. It's totally appreciated, John Nagel. But it sounds like you're also concerned that these lessons from Iraq are being lost now. I mean, I read a review by Dexter Filkins of your book that seemed to think this is kind of irrelevant now, counterinsurgency. I don't understand it, but I want you to explain where that's coming
sure.
from.
So Dexter said both the nicest and the meanest things about me that have ever been said in print in
yeah.
successive sentences. It's a remarkable New York Times book review. So there was, I think, for the pendulum swings. And so for many years after Vietnam, the pendulum swung away from counterinsurgency, and the Army and the nation decided we were never going to do that again. And then we learned that the enemy gets a vote, and the enemy in both Iraq and Afghanistan chose to fight us as insurgents. And the radical Islamic extremists, Al-Qaeda, and its affiliates fight as arguably as a global insurgency. And so the only way to defeat them is with a global counterinsurgency campaign. And so we don't get to choose necessarily what kind of wars we have to fight. The pendulum swung away from, I think, counterinsurgency. And now I believe, and I hope, and I hope that my book and my speaking is having some role in this. People are recognizing that we are conducting counterinsurgency still in Afghanistan. We are conducting counterinsurgency in Iraq in support of the Iraqi army and the Kurdish army there. We are conducting counterinsurgency in Yemen in support of and in with the assistance of the Yemeni government. We're conducting counterinsurgency inside Pakistan in counterterrorism operations inside Pakistan in support of the Pakistani government. And so as long as insurgency remains a tool, a technique, a mode of warfare by which our enemies attempt to achieve objectives that we find deplorable, we are going to be required to conduct counterinsurgency to defeat them. And that's true whether we like it or not. And I think I think a lot of people are having a hard time swallowing the bitter taste of that, given how extraordinarily painful and difficult the Iraq and Afghanistan wars have been for our great nation. The answer to that can't be, as it was after Vietnam, to burn the books and decide never to do that again. I believe the answer has to be to get as good at counterinsurgency as we are at conventional warfare, and so to demonstrate to our enemies that we have no weak spots. There are no soft spots on our tank where you can attack us. And we have not yet come to that determination, I don't believe.
You mentioned Afghanistan. Just a quick question there. How do you think President Obama has handled Afghanistan? And I guess I would wonder, you know, what's the best we can expect from all that, from our operations there?
So I'm critical of the president's, some of the president's decisions in Afghanistan. In particular, he decided to surge troops into Afghanistan. He did that twice over the course of his first year in office, 2009. I'm in particular critical of the second decision to surge troops into Afghanistan. Both were necessary. The second decision, he undercut the number required by the commanders on the ground by 10,000. And more importantly, he announced the withdrawal date for those soldiers literally simultaneous with the order to deploy them. And so he told our enemies how long they needed to wait out our surge of resources, our surge of efforts into Afghanistan. And so I believe that the president has been a very reluctant warrior in Afghanistan, despite campaigning on Afghanistan as the good war. All that, in comparison with the Iraq war, all that said, Afghanistan has every chance of being far too costly, taking far too long. The biggest mistake we made in Afghanistan was invading Iraq a year and a half in, rather than finishing the war in Afghanistan. It would have been comparatively easy to have devoted a fairly small number of resources, relatively small number of troops to Afghanistan. We took our eye off that ball, focused on Iraq, and by the time we focused back on Afghanistan, the Taliban had regained strength there, and the war was almost lost. The surge in Afghanistan, the growing strength of the Afghan security forces pushed that back, and we are now in a precarious point where, as long as the United States, I believe, continues to maintain a troop presence of some 15 to 20,000 soldiers in Afghanistan, again, for the foreseeable future, I believe, for decades to come, I believe that Afghanistan has a real chance to be a stable, somewhat democratic country in a very, very dangerous neighborhood, a place where we will continue to want to have bases from which to operate, from which to gather intelligence, in particular to keep an eye on Pakistan, in my eyes, the most dangerous country in the world. And let me just highlight how extraordinarily far Afghanistan has come over the course of the last 13 years since the horrible attacks of September 11th. There were zero girls in education, being educated in Afghanistan on September 11th, 2001. Today, there are well over a million, I believe close to 2 million, out of a total of some 5 or 6 million total kids in Afghanistan being educated. There were fewer than 1,000 telephones in Afghanistan in 2001. There are more than 15 million telephones in Afghanistan today. And a higher percentage of the Afghan people think their country is going in the right direction and their children's futures will be brighter than theirs than the American people do. So Afghanistan, as long as we maintain a relatively small commitment to that country for the long term, a commitment that President Ashraf Ghani of Afghanistan, whom I know and admire, has repeatedly asked for, I believe that Afghanistan has a good chance to be, to fall into the, it took too long and it cost too much, but it turned out reasonably okay category of Korea rather than the we lost it category of Vietnam.
Right. Hey, John, we're quickly running out of time here. I haven't run out of questions, though, unfortunately. I'd like to maybe have you on the show again another time. I have enjoyed this conversation. I do have this question, because you mentioned that you had been a teacher at both West Point and Annapolis. And, of course, we're close to Annapolis here, so I'm sort of eager to ask you to compare those two. What was it like? How would you describe West Point versus the Naval Academy in terms of teaching?
So I really expected it to be a very similar experience. And I'll tell my joke quickly. I thought that since I taught at West Point, I'd be just fine at Navy as long as I spoke slowly and used small words. In my eyes, the two finest undergraduate institutions in this great nation, West Point and the Naval Academy. Right, my bitterness has nothing to do with the fact that during Army Navy Week, the midshipmen broke into my office and saran wrapped everything in it.
Individual books,
ballpoint pens, my computer, my mouse, everything. Right, it could have been worse. It could have been water balloons. But the truth is that the two institutions are far more different than I thought. Hmm. The Naval Academy has a predominantly civilian faculty. West Point has a predominantly military faculty. And so my own belief is that the Navy midshipmen receive a better academic education, perhaps, but don't receive as much training, and in particular don't receive as much inspiration from young military officers like the young Captain David Petraeus, who was one of the people who really inspired me to a career in the military when I was a young West Point cadet. These many years ago.
Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned here, we're just short of time, that people in the Navy work harder than people in the Army overall.
Boy, are my Army buddies going to give me a hard time for that one.
It's the nature of the work, right?
It's the nature of the work, and that's particularly true in the submarine force. So while I was serving at the Naval Academy, I had the chance to go underway aboard a Virginia-class attack submarine. Every square foot, every cubic foot of a submarine is worth millions and millions and millions of dollars. So they keep it really, really small and really tight, and they don't have enough people on board to really do all the work. And so they work those guys, and now women, unbelievably hard. And so my dad had been a nuclear submariner. I have so much respect for our naval forces, and in particular for our submarine force, who do just unbelievable things to keep us safe every day. God bless them. Better them than me.
John Nagel, I've enjoyed this. I'm sure our listeners have, too. Thank you so much for being on our show today. Maybe we'll hook up again another day. John Nagel, a retired lieutenant colonel of the U.S. Army, as you can tell, a graduate of West Point, and now a headmaster.
One of these years.
Now headmaster at the Haverford School in Pennsylvania. This book we've been talking about is called Knife Fights, A Memoir of Modern War in Theory and Practice. The publisher is Penguin Press. Again, my thanks. Thank you very much, John.
A pleasure, Dan.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed our program today, midday, Monday through Friday, noon to 2, right here on WYPR. Thanks so much for tuning in. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon. We'll see you again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richman, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spignall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.